21-3470, United States of America versus Gregory Vandermark. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Hanley for the defendant appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel for the United States. My name is Patrick Hanley, and I represent the appellant Gregory Vandermark. I'd like to hold 5 minutes in for rebuttal, if that would be okay.
That's fine. Thank you.
Your Honor, this is an appeal from a decision by the lower court denying my motion for judgment of acquittal at the end of the jury trial and my motion for a new trial. The appellant, Mr. Vandermark, was charged in a six-count indictment. The first four counts were he was charged with aiding and assisting in the preparation and presentation of a false and fraudulent tax return. Counts one and two related to their tax return for Used Car Supermarket, his company, for the years 2013 and 14. Counts three and four were related to his own personal returns for the same years. Count five was a structuring count, and count six was a false statement count. He was alleged that he made false statements to an IRS agent during the investigation. The evidence relative to counts one and two, which is at the crux of this whole case, is that Mr. Vandermark had a company called Used Car Supermarket who was leasing automobiles, and he received security deposits in connection with the lease of these automobiles. And he was told in 2013 and 14 that these were unreported because they were not income at that time. They would not become income until they were earned or received. Well,
tell me this, in prior years, prior to 2013, did he in fact report them as income, these deposits?
My understanding is that he had. Yes, that's correct. These were all cash.
Right.
And but what about these? So presumably it comes in 2013 and 2014. Was it reported in 2015 and 2016?
Well, those returns, I'm not sure. I don't know, Your Honor. I wasn't concerned with what occurred.
But if you had, I'm curious why you wouldn't have been concerned about that, because if you had reported it in 2015 instead of in 2013, then your only dispute with the IRS would have been a timing dispute. And I find it hard to believe that the IRS would bring a criminal prosecution if it was just a timing dispute.
That's in effect what this was. It was a timing dispute.
But did you in fact report them in 2015? And you said to the government, hey, we put this on the 2015 return, not on the 2013 return. So, hey, we can't be willful. We just have a disagreement about timing.
Well, the investigation, I believe, started in 2016. I'm not even sure that the returns were had to be filed at that time.
But in fact, what did report them, say, these cash security deposits in 2011, 2012?
Excuse me?
I mean, prior to the 13, 14 years we're talking about, in 2012, apparently he did report these security deposits as income, and then just stopped in 2013 and 2000.
That was the evidence.
Yeah, well, and isn't that sort of incriminating?
He stopped because he realized that these were security deposits that under a decision by the United States Supreme Court are not income.
Okay, so for all the years prior to 13, I reported them unnecessarily. Did he ever ask for a refund for those?
It's not that you get a refund. It's, again, a timing issue. You have to report the money when you, in fact, are entitled to the money.
Right.
Now, and if he, whenever you get these security deposits and they have to be returned at some point, they're not income. But when you don't have to return them, they become income.
Okay. Now, wasn't the evidence from, Christopher McAfee, was his long-term 30-year employee, said that over the whole period of time, he doesn't recall more than, say, three refunds ever being received.
That's correct. That's what he said. And he also said, Your Honor, that what happened was there weren't refunds because under the terms of the lease agreement, the contract between Vandermark, used car supermarket, and the customers, the customer had the right to use those security deposit as a credit if they decided to buy the cars. And that's, in fact, what he said happened to the money. The customers got credit for all of this when they decided to buy the cars.
But the point is that he had, the question is, I suppose, did he have full dominance and use of those deposits, though, during the time they sat with him?
The Supreme Court case in Indianapolis says that if you receive that money, you can use those security deposits however you feel is appropriate. That does not change the issue. As long as you have an obligation to return those monies, that is not your money, that is not income. And that's the crucial issue in the case.
And that requires that the taxpayer be able to say that he has a guarantee that he will be allowed to keep the money. And wasn't that the problem here, that under the terms of the lease there really was no guarantee to the the key there being who can keep the money, right?
Well, Your Honor, that's what the government alleged. There is a contract that said these people were entitled to the money, provided they complied with the terms of the lease agreement.
All right, but it's part of the problem. The point of the terms of the lease agreement was they couldn't have excess mileage, but there was no mileage ever designated of what would be excess. So it was totally up to your client.
That was one issue.
And the other was nicks and dings to the car, excessive wear and tear, and that too was totally up to your client.
Well, in any lease agreement you have with any car dealership, those would be consistent. They would be the same. Now, you still have your rights under the contract that you can enforce by going in court, if you have to, and establishing there was no damage and establishing that you didn't have excess mileage if that came to a crux above industry standards, which were 12,000 miles.
12,000 is not mentioned in the lease contract.
I understand that. McAfee mentioned that as the industry standard that he would have enforced. But he said in no case, except for two or three cases, the customers got the benefit of their security deposit as a credit when they decided to buy the cars.
But there was no... This agreement seems more like a financing agreement than a lease. In other words, you're making a down payment on the car because everybody, in effect, is buying the car, right? I mean, there's one or two instances of refunds ever happening. Oh, he testified over his whole entire time there, right?
Yep.
And the amount of the quote-unquote security deposit is, I mean, some of them were $2,000. I mean, they were pretty high numbers for what you would think of as a security deposit. It looked more like a down payment, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. Respectfully, under the terms of the lease, it was up to the individual customer to make that decision.
But every time they made that, I mean, every time they made the same decision.
Well,
did the company book it as a liability when they got the money in it? Because in Indianapolis, they booked it as a liability, right?
That's a big utility. This is a small used car dealership. I mean, no, they didn't comply.
Accounting principles don't change necessarily just because it's a big utility versus a small dealership.
I understand
that. If your theory is that it wasn't income to your client because he had to pay it back if they met the terms, you'd think he'd list it as a liability.
I understand that, Your Honor, but he didn't.
Isn't the real issue here the standard? I mean, this is a Rule 29 motion for acquittal, and under that, isn't the standard, even though we may be arguing about the particulars of the facts, but what we're looking at is whether a rational trier of fact could find that the cash deposits were taxable income. And if that's the case, then you lose the Rule 29 motion. Isn't that the standard?
You also have a Rule 33 motion that was filed, Your Honor.
Well, what's the standard on the Rule 33 motion? That's a motion for a new trial. That's a tough standard.
Where's our timing? Do we have time?
There's only 8 minutes going, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, is there?
Is it 8 seconds?
My argument is about over.
Yes, that's okay. Please.
No, yesterday we had big things on the screens with the time.
Someone was on video. Go ahead and answer the question. That's fine.
Well, Your Honor, as I indicated in my brief, the standard under the motion for a new trial is substantially different than the standard under the motion for judgment of acquittal. And we just have to establish that there was a miscarriage of justice. In other words,
that's a pretty tough standard, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, if you have agreements that the Supreme Court has basically in a similar situation ruled that this establishes that their security deposits are not income, that is a miscarriage of justice.
Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal.
May it please the court, Megan Gaffney Painter on behalf of the United States. I represented the United States at trial below, and I represent the United States here on appeal. As a jury concluded, the defendant—
Can I ask you a question? I don't think these deposits were ever reported as income, whether it was in the 2013, 2014, or 20 whatever, right?
No. In 2012 and before, the defendant reported these deposits as income on his tax
return. I'm curious why you prosecuted this case picking just the 2 years of returns, because it presents this issue of whether the security deposits are actually reportable income or not, as opposed to basically just a general tax evasion case where the income was never reported. So we wouldn't have to pick out whether it was 2016 or 15 or 13 or whatever it was. But you're basically, the way you prosecuted it, you're forcing us to look at this timing question, which I think makes it a much more difficult case, doesn't it?
Potentially, but the facts here are, well, let's start at the beginning of the investigation, which was testified to by Special Agent McCullough. The way this investigation started was a report by the bank that Mr. Vandermark had been making a series of suspicious all-cash payments underneath the $10,000 threshold. And when the IRS took a look at that behavior, they noticed, wow, this is a taxpayer whose corporation and individual returns reported a significantly higher income in these previous years, and now, when he's making all cash payments beneath the $10,000 threshold, sometimes multiple times in the same month towards his mortgage, he's also reporting negative taxable income, both on his personal returns and on the corporate returns. And so an examination of that, looking at what he was reporting, the change in the way he was recording these deposits, when the search warrants were executed and the agents find the second set of handwritten books that detail the actual amount of money that's coming into the corporation, and then also this undercover call where the defendant admits to an undercover officer, because he believes he's, you know, an interested purchaser, that he's skimming 25% of the business's money out in green dollars. I mean, we charge these tax counts because we met the elements of those tax counts.
Right, but if I said, look, 2012, I didn't report this as income because it's just a security deposit, and then on my 2015 return, I report them as income when the cars get sold. It's a 3-year deal, let's say, and I report them all on my 2015 return. And you think, no, you should have, if the service thinks, no, you should have reported it in 2012, that's not a criminal case, right? If I have a disagreement with the service about the timing of when I recognize income, we have a disagreement, we would probably end up maybe in court, I don't know. But I can't imagine that the service would say, oh, that's a criminal case, right?
Absolutely, because in that example, you would not be necessarily meeting the willfulness requirement,
right,
of the mens rea. Now, consider, the defendant was interviewed for 3.5 hours in 2016 by the IRS agents. He knew what they were looking for. They didn't hide the ball. He never once during that time mentioned, I'm receiving, you know, I changed my accounting method. I changed the way that I consider these security deposits because I have received this advice or because I have changed my position on how this should be accounted. And let me assure you that when I file my taxes, I plan to account for this missing time. I plan to take the timing into account. He mentioned none of it.
So why is that not just a tax evasion case? Why is that not a just tax evasion as opposed to willfully assisting in the preparation of a fraudulent return or whatever? I mean, maybe it is the latter, which is the counts one and two, but that makes it a difficult case because we have to decide whether you're actually right about whether it was income at the time in 2012 or 13 or whatever it is, 13 or 14. As opposed to just saying, look, you're evading tax because you never paid tax on this. You just put the cash in a safe, took it out, paid your mortgage, never planning to report it as income on any return ever. It's just forcing the court's hand, I think, on this particular question, right?
We don't view it as forcing the court's hand. I mean, this, we may have raised the level of difficulty on ourselves by charging, you know, material misstatements as opposed to a tax evasion case. But this is not a difficult case, as essentially the jury concluded as well, as it deliberated for something like 4 hours and decided that we had met the elements of these offenses. Given these facts and given the evidence that we had of intent and given the way that these returns were prepared, it fits the charge of 7206, providing a material misstatement in the preparation of a return.
And because it's a preparation issue, you think it didn't play any role in the case that the 2013 taxes were never filed at all?
Absolutely. Because of both the plain text of the statute, which outlaws preparation or presentation. If it were preparation and presentation, mm-hmm, potentially we do have an issue with the 2013 personal return. But here, given the plain text, preparation qualifies.
But in your investigation, you would not have had a 2013 return to show that he had changed the method of reporting, right? Because it was never filed.
That's right. It was contained in the files of Mr. Wilson, his tax preparer, and that's how we had the copy of the 2013 return, because his tax preparer maintained a copy of it in his files.
And so the only, when you began your investigation and decided your charge, you only had the 2014 filing to show that he had in fact not included in income anywhere near the amount from 2012?
No, when we decided to charge, which was in 2018, at that time we had the 2013 return that he had prepared with Mr. Wilson because we had received documents from Mr. Wilson related to this case. So at the time the charging decision was made, we had the 2013.
You had
return.
Both, okay. I'm sorry I interrupted.
I don't understand this. If I prepare a fraudulent return and I prepare I put it in my desk drawer, and then I have a change of heart and file an actual return that's not fraudulent, am I still guilty of a crime just because I prepared a fraudulent return? Even if I never filed it, never presented it to the IRS, it's just sitting in my desk drawer?
I mean, under the plain text of the statute, arguably yes, but that is certainly,
I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it?
Right, and you would hope that the prosecutor executing her discretion would not charge that case where someone did not in the future demonstrate an actual willingness to mislead the IRS.
I mean, let me ask you this question. In this case, my understanding is the testimony was that he or the accountant or whoever it was tried to file it electronically, was unsuccessful, and then mailed it, and the service apparently doesn't have a record of it, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Is that not presentation?
Well, arguably it is presentation. Two circuits believe that if there is a filing requirement in this statute, which, by the way, not only the plain text disagrees with that conclusion, but also a prior unpublished decision by the Sixth Circuit, United States versus Feaster, said that filing is not required.
And by filing, you mean receipt by the IRS?
Well, so the Ninth
Acknowledged Circuit, receipt?
Yes, the Ninth Circuit believes that's what filing means. Now, two separate circuits say, look, if filing is required, providing it to a third party who is legally obligated to submit it to the IRS meets your filing requirement. And under that sort of construction, we meet that here, too, because Mr. Vandermark approved the tax return, signed it, provided it to Mr. Wilson, and as far as Mr. Vandermark knew, that return was received by the IRS because Mr. Wilson was responsible for submitting it. And you're absolutely right that it was he attempted to submit it electronically, it was rejected, and then he mailed it in.
So what shows, what in your, in the government's view, shows his intent, let's say, to not pay tax on what he supposedly knew was income or should be income?
In the government's view, we have the defendant's own words on a recorded phone call with an undercover officer. I'm telling you something I maybe shouldn't be talking about, but 25% of that big number I told you comes out in green dollars. So you have him saying there, you know, I'm taking 25% out and I probably shouldn't be telling you this, which, by the way, if he believed this were an absolutely appropriate use of recording and accounting, you assume he would be shouting it from the rooftops that his accountant had come up with a method for him to pay zero in federal income tax and make $1 million a year. But instead, he's, you know, nervous about revealing this information. He also says on that call that he shoves expenses back onto the company because he doesn't want to pay all those dang taxes, is what he says. We also have two sets of books. We have the handwritten ledger books from the two car lots that detailed every dollar going in and out of that business.
Those are the green ledgers?
Exactly, the green ledger books. Everything was detailed in those books. But what do we have on the tax end? We have QuickBooks. That's the program that he used, and it kept track of his cash based solely on the bank deposits. So the only money that shows up on the QuickBooks is the money that he deposits into the bank. We had testimony from Mr. McAfee that in 2013 or 2014, the defendant instructed him, hey, stop putting that cash in the bank. Put it in this safe in my office because I need to pay down a loan. So that money, those deposits, never made their way to the bank, so they never made their way to the bank statements, so they never made their way to the QuickBooks.
My understanding is, maybe I'm wrong about this, for the years 2013 and 2014, there were some number of leases that were entered into in 2013 or 14 and also ended in 13 or 14.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, and so the money, if the defense theory is correct, they would have recognized that income at least for that lease in that year, right?
Absolutely. And in rebuttal, the government presented the jury with an example of seven leases introduced by the defense that were paid off during that 2013-2014 period and by his own accounting and by the testimony of his retained expert would have been required at that point to be moved into the income column, and they were not. This money, these deposits, it's essentially ghost money. It appears nowhere, not as a liability, as you pointed out when you were questioning the appellant. They don't appear on the balance sheet as a liability, and they don't appear in the income column. The only place that they exist is in these green ledger books and on these lease documents, but on none of the documents that are provided to the tax preparer. We showed the green ledger books to Mr. Wilson during trial. He said, I have never seen these before.
So obviously we have security deposits that are put down all over the country every day. Landlords, for example, whatever. How do you distinguish all of those situations where it's not income from this particular situation?
Well, we look to the guidance provided in Commissioner versus Indianapolis Power and Light. There, the Supreme Court was assessing, how do we tell when something is a genuine refundable security deposit and thus not necessarily income versus actual income when it's received by the taxpayer. And the guidance they provided is to look holistically. You know, look at the rights and obligations of the taxpayer.
But I thought the service took the position at one point that if it was securing a non, the performance of a non-income producing covenant, that that was not going to be income. In other words, if I'm securing the car, if I'm securing against damage to the car, for example, that's not going to be income producing, right? Why is that not a problem for you here?
Because in this instance, following this case, we are to look at the rights and obligations of the parties as they exist at the time of the agreement, right? There could be a construction of an agreement that sets forth that this is truly a deposit that is there to ensure that should damage be incurred, this money will be used to pay for that damage. That's not necessarily income, depending on sort of the other circumstances and atmospherics surrounding that. But here,
wasn't that part of the lease here?
It is, except looking at the terms of the lease, who decides if there's damage? Under the terms of the lease, Vandermark and his employees are the, quote, sole judge.
Isn't that true of any car lease? I mean, are all car lease security deposits considered income by the government?
I apologize for interrupting you. No, in general, I think you'd have to look, again, at the rights and obligations. Look at the surrounding circumstances in order to assess who has some guarantee that they will receive this money. Who has the control over how this money is used at the end of the terms of the contract? So I think there would be some leases that would qualify as where the deposit should be income and some leases where they wouldn't be. It just is a very fact-specific inquiry, as the Supreme Court outlined in Indianapolis Power and Light. And one of the facts...
But I think that any car situation, I mean, Indianapolis Power and Light, the court makes it clear this is a highly regulated industry. These contracts, there's a state law involved. It does seem like there's a guarantee that you're going to get the money back in certain circumstances. If I go lease a car from anybody, Toyota, Mercedes, whoever it is, I mean, there's going to be something in there about how it's, you know, under their discretion, or they're going to look at the damage to the car, or they're going to take some money out. Or a landlord, of course, who, you know, when I vacate the apartment, they go in and look at it, and then they send me a bill and take the money out. I don't know why. I mean, that would... seems to me put on the table all kinds of security deposits as income around the country. And that can't be right, can it?
Potentially. I mean, it
potentially, is, yes?
Well, potentially in terms of how is this, you know, when we're assessing is this income or not, it's not a simple question of what is the taxpayer calling it. It's what are the actual terms of this agreement? What are the circumstances surrounding it? For instance, in this case, we have every cash deposit, almost every cash deposit in this case, there's a receipt provided to the leaser or purchaser of the car that says no refunds. You have a 30-year employee saying maybe one, maybe two, maybe three times in 30 years did we ever refund this deposit. You also have the testimony here at trial of Revenue Agent Schaefer, who said, I looked at every single transaction from 2012 through 2014, and I found a single instance of a deposit refunded. And it was a partial refund the same day that it was issued. That's the only time that this was refunded. So one could presume that in a case where a car leaser operating in good faith is keeping the deposits 99% of the time and in under the terms of the lease has significant control over whether he will receive that deposit at the end of the term, that should be counted as income. Now, could there be...
I think, Counselor, your time's about up. Why don't you summarize?
So, Your Honor, I apologize for going over my time, but here the district court's denial of the Rule 29 and Rule 33 motions was correct, and the United States urges this court to affirm.
Thank you.
I'm going to try and break this case down fundamentally. The income in this case consisted of the security deposits and all of the payments. They were all in cash. They were all reported up until 2013. In 2013 and 14, the security deposits weren't reported because they were security deposits. All the cash payments made by all the customers were reported, according to the government. This undercover tape that the government has offered in evidence here and during a trial, that concerned a person who was going to buy, who was talking about buying the business. Sure, there was a lot of puffing going on, but the fact of the matter is the government's own evidence established that Vandermark reported all cash from the payments made by the customer.
Not the security deposits.
The security deposits in 13 and 14, he did not report because under the commissioner case, it is not income.
But But was there any claim he got suddenly good tax advice at the beginning of 2013?
Yes, Your Honor.
Really? From who?
McAfee, the government's own witness, claimed that Vandermark told him that his accountant said that was, he could do that because security deposits are not income.
Well, but Wilson's his accountant, and Wilson never said he told him.
I understand that, Judge. I'm well aware of that.
What about the leases that ended in 13 and 14?
Now, there were about seven of those leases that income was not reported. I'm just asking, let us go to the jury and present that. If that's their case, if their case consists of income from the security deposits from seven cases, they wouldn't win that. They wouldn't bring that case.
I guess we're back at the same concern I had on the Rule 29 motion. You're on a Rule 33 motion where you've got a jury verdict. And you presented your, I'm assuming the argument you're making here, you fully made to the jury. So how can you overcome the standard of review and get a new trial? That is an exceedingly difficult standard.
I understand that, Your Honor. But you have a situation here where you have customers making a security deposit. There is an agreement. That agreement provides that security deposit will be returned. There's a contractual language that sets that up, that provides those customers with relief if they, not one customer in this case was complaining that they didn't get it. The fact of the matter is they got credit for all their security deposits when they decided to apply their security deposit as a credit towards the payment of the car.
But the inference is that your client, I mean, they got all that they were, but the inference is your client was never going to report to the IRS these security deposits.
That's an inference that is, Your Honor, that has just not been established in the case. I mean,
but if a reasonable juror makes that inference, but if a reasonable juror makes that inference, isn't that the resolution of the case unless you can meet the Rule 33 standard? That's where I'm just hung up. I don't see a way around it. You just disagree with what the jury did, but that's the essence of a Rule 33 standard of review.
Well, it's not consistent with Rule 29. But look, the government during the trial attempted to say that the security deposits were income because of the method of accounting that the taxpayer was using, that is cash or accrual. And of course, that is bogus. That has nothing to do with whether money has to be reported. It has to be income before you decide whether it's a report on a cash basis or accrual basis. If it's not income, it's not reportable.
Was the jury instruction, my understanding, the jury instruction doesn't say something like you must find that there was complete dominion or control, or it doesn't use any of the language from the Indianapolis case, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Was the jury effectively making that decision, or is that some kind of a legal decision for
the
court?
Your Honor, in my opinion, it is a quasi-legal decision that should have been made. It wasn't made in this case. And as a result...
Well, by who? I mean, Judge Barrett made the decision.
Well, he made the decision after the trial.
We thank you both for your arguments and for your briefing. The case will be taken under advisement and an opinion issued in due course. The remainder of our docket today is not oral argument. It's on the briefs. So would you adjourn court, please?
This honorable court stands adjourned.